Welcome to Hot Plate, a post-foodie podcast. I'm your host, Mirella Amato. Today on Hot Plate, coming to you from the isolation of our homes. Discomfort food, the blue revolution, hospital food, and full muscle product. Hi, Josh. Now, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm all right, Mirella. It's the heat is here now, which is sort of a nice thing. It's a bit of a nice change, but mostly because that means strawberries are also here. And so that has been one of the most cheerful things about this week has been the strawberries. How are you?
So the socks are off?
Oh my God, the socks are off with so much joy. Thank you for asking.
I remember you saying that earlier.
Oh my God, my feet are really happy. It's the truth.
Oh, wow. I wish I could find some joy in this heat. But yeah, it's if mega. I'm not in a lake, I'm not interested in the heat at all.
It's the truth,
it
isn't
no purpose,
it?
But to warm me up post-swim.
Right. Oh, man. I've been dreaming, actually, about sitting on a dock, you know, and that delight of all you have to do is if you get hot, jump in the water, back out again like that. The laziness of those days is something I could really use right now.
Yeah, with a nice cold beer.
This is it, girl. This is it.
Some guac. Some homemade guac.
Homemade guac. This is the stuff of dreams. And all you have to think about is what you're going to put on the barbecue later on. Come on.
That's right.
Meanwhile.
Always dream. Yeah.
Indeed. So, meanwhile, here we are.
I read this article, which led me to discover this fine gentleman that I had never heard of before. I'm guessing you might be familiar with his work.
Yes.
Because he seems to be very much on the radar within the industry and beloved. So the gentleman in question is, his name is Tunde Wei.
Yes.
And I mean, everything about him fascinates me. I agree. That he likes to serve discomfort food.
I know. And articulates it as such, right?
It's right. Great. And I also really love that what he's doing, really, a lot of it is performance art.
Yes.
Some might see it as activism. I come from an art background. And so, you know, to me, I think it could be seen through either lens.
I agree.
Some of my favorite things that he did was in New Orleans, where I believe he's currently living.
I think so.
He set up a lunch cart. And he had separate prices for white people and black people.
I know. No, it's such a bold move. Yes.
Yeah. And I love, he had a sign out front. Let me see if I can find it. It said, it was a sandwich board. It said, "This is more than lunch. This is an experiment. How can you impact racial wealth disparity?" Mm. So he really made it clear, you know, what the performance or the pop-up.
He was being tricked, right.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that is even more daring is he set up a pop-up in Nashville where he served Nashville hot chicken. Have you experienced?
Yes. A Nashville hot brown, yes. Well, not in Nashville. I've experienced a replica outside, but I've never been to Nashville.
Oh, I experienced it last year. That's a story for a separate occasion.
All right. It's definitely on the list.
Yeah. It's hot.
Yeah.
Anyway, he served Nashville hot chicken. It was free for black residents. Okay. And then white diners who showed up had to pledge hundreds and thousands of dollars.
Right.
Just for a piece or two.
And remind us, do we have follow-up on how that went and whether what level of white patronage there was at that pop-up?
I have not found that information. Okay. I've found a lot of descriptions of the mood at the event and, you know, everyone sort of figuring out what was going on.
Right.
And I do know that it was very well received.
Okay.
So he seems to really have this knack.
That's wonderful. I love that.
Very, uncomfortable things, right? It is discomfort in a way that that leads people to think.
Yes.
And, you know, which all good art does, right?
Indeed. And good activism too, right? I love the notion of the plate being a forum for this mega conversation, right? That's clearly right up my alley. And for him to just be brave enough to do it is amazing.
Yes. So what I wanted to talk about today was the crux of this article, which was the fact that he has put forward this idea that that we should just let the restaurant industry die.
I know.
That, you know, the idea of coronavirus ending and us just going back to the way things were before, which is what most of the industry would like, is not worth it. And he has some pretty strong views about it, but
I'm curious
to know your thoughts.
Yeah, he really
especially
does.
Especially in light of our conversation with Hessel two episodes ago about all of the problems that are really, you know, the mental health issues and the security issues that are prevalent in the industry.
It is a real thing. And I will confess that when I read this piece a couple of times now, but when I first read it, I was just like, buddy, we can't do that. Come on. How many people's lives will lie in the wake? Like, what are the costs of just letting it die? Because it's right. And because it's personal for me, it's my friends, right? Yeah. It's my people whose restaurants I've helped promote and patron, you know what I mean? I'm like, and it's a huge part of our culture. And so that feels really alarmist, right? I'm like, how? I'm just really alarmed by that. It's not alarmist. But I am really, but when
it's
you think about it, it's a very dramatic statement.
Yes.
It's a lot, right?
It's not let's change, right?
Precisely.
Let it die.
But it's like, you can see the thinking behind it though, right? Because essentially is the idea that like accelerate the destruction so as to bring the change and the rebirth that much sooner, right? I think that that is really the spirit behind it.
And take advantage of this moment, which has already started this.
This is it, right?
Not
this
necessarily
is
necessarily destruction, but certainly a decline.
Right. And it's a compelling thought to sort of shift our efforts from attempting to rescue and, you know what I mean? And like first aid or triage this declining thing and let it just naturally come to an end and focus more energy on what the rebuild needs to look like. Right. It is ideologically very compelling. Right. And it makes a lot of sense. So one of the things this really reminded me of was this sort of like a parallel argument that I see in the community food security space, right? Where there are a bunch of people who really believe that what we need to do is shut down food banks completely,
right?
And devote all of the resources that we would have spent towards food banks, towards advocacy for things like basic general income, higher social assistance rates, and more general community food security. Right. And that we just stop the band-aid, right? Because essentially a food bank
eliminate the actual need.
Precisely. Yeah. And just figure out the root issue for what forces people to stand in that lineup every month. And so the parallels are quite similar. And it's compelling.
That's exactly what he's saying, right? Because his point is that if the government gives the restaurant industry the bailouts that it's requesting, then the restaurant industry will just go back to the way it was before.
Right.
And the main issue he's identified is exactly the same one you're talking about. And that in the context of hospitality, it's the fact that hospitality is often seen as, you know, a safety net for people who, in other words, a place people who might otherwise not be able to find a job, people who perhaps are undocumented or people with a criminal background can often still get a job in the hospitality industry.
Right.
And his whole point is, you know, it's great, but the whole industry is built around the fact that, you know, I don't want to say they can take advantage of these people, but you know, that these people, are, you know, eager to be there and they're still underpaid and they're still, and so his whole point is the same as what you were outlining for the food banks is the, you know, the money should go to social assistance programs and helping these people out so that anyone who's working in the restaurant industry and the hospitality industry is doing it because they really want to be there. And anyone who you know, can take on the job that they want and not, you know, the only option that they have, which puts them in a very precarious position.
It does. And one of the things that I wonder about is the ripple out to other areas. Like, right, we see a lot of aspiring artists working in restaurants, mm-hmm. right? That practice exists.
Actors,
yeah. Exactly, right? So what mm-hmm. happens, right? If now the tenor of these jobs has changed, right? And they're, and the hospitality industry potentially changes from being this sort of this public safety net. What's going to happen to those other folks? I mean, that's one piece, and I'm sure we can all be creative enough to figure this out. But in addition, something that I feel like I can't turn away from with this argument is the impact piece, right? Because while the level of destruction that will be required to get from where we are now to this new version of our industry, it's mega, right? The mm-hmm. what will lie in the wake. At the same time, we as sort of members of this industry make the argument that the reason we need a bailout, an industry-specific bailout, is because we are the only industry that employs so many diverse networks of people, and that there's like an efficiency connected to, like, you know, support, bail out the hospitality industry, and you will automatically bail out florists and linen, you know what I mean? And beer and, you know, breweries and, you know, and that, and mm-hmm. farmers and that sort of thing. And so I still feel like that's a compelling argument. However, maybe it works on the other way. Maybe we can say, if we really want to fix this problem, focus on the hospital, you know, focus on actually rebuilding this thing so that that's, those new ideas can actually ripple out to all those industries as well. I mean, it's very positive idealist thinking, but maybe that's what we need right now, you know?
For sure. You know, I don't know how serious he is mm-hmm. when he says, let it die, you know, in terms of
He pushes back on the language a little bit. He's always like, I don't quite mean it that. And, you know, it's more of a metaphor. Yeah. And he's looking ahead to the phoenix rising from the ashes, right?
Because he's also part of this industry.
Yes, right? He's got something to lose, exactly.
And, you know, there's no easy solution, but I think it's definitely a really interesting conversation to start having. And, you know, maybe they're not mutually exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some assistance for the industry would be welcome, because you raise a really good point with all of the other people who depend on the industry. That would be a big problem. But then also focus some energy on, you know, government programs that can help.
And I think that the real wealth of this piece and Tunde Wei's perspective is the really sharp reminder that restoring the way things were before the pandemic hit should not be our goal.
Yes.
Right? It was not working on so many levels. And so we as members of the industry, I think, need to be courageous enough to actually acknowledge that.
Josh, now I read this article that has me thinking in all kinds of different directions.
Yes.
I really wanted to share it with you and see mm-hmm. Which thoughts it brought up for you as well. But this article is written in criticism of the Indian government's program called Blue Revolution.
Right.
And this is a program that there's two sides to it. First of all, they really want to address malnutrition issues in the country, and specifically anemia and protein deficiency. And they also want to help fish farmers prosper. So what they've decided to do is to invest a lot to help their local fish farmers do well, and then use that seafood to address this malnutrition mm-hmm. issue. And the person who wrote the article was essentially pointing out that, you know, while the spirit is wonderful, our oceans are being pillaged right now, and it's probably the worst place to look for a solution.
Right.
And, you know, some of the statistics that this article pulled out, I know that the oceans are a big problem, and mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. we are, it's definitely, you know, everyone's talking about
overfishing, you know,
oh, are they? Yeah. Well, I'm hearing more about, you know, the carbon footprint of beef, and should we
eat the
chicken?
Of course. Yes.
And then, you know, I'm still seeing, if you want to be healthy, eat chicken and fish, right? Everyone wants to still be able to eat their fish. But he was talking about unseasonable weather in Canada just for a few weeks resulted in the loss of 2.6 million fish that they had to clean out.
Yeah. What a sad salmon it was, I think, right?
Yes. It was Atlantic salmon.
Yeah.
And then also talking about the fact that 90% of wild fisheries are classified as overfished or harvested at maximum capacity.
Right.
And that this is what's pushing, I didn't realize this, but this is what's pushing fishing into unregulated areas, which is where we get this problem that I'm sure you've heard about, the mislabeled fish.
Oh, yes.
Apparently 44%. Of fish.
I did not know it was as high as 44.
Countries like ours are mislabeled because, you know, there's this huge demand for fish and there's nowhere to get it. So that was all pretty depressing to read.
It is a very doomy scenario. And especially, I mean, I was curious about the Indian context, and then it all kicked in, of course, which is the fact that India is virtually all coastline.
Right.
Right. That narrow pointed triangle, the peninsula, right, of that country is really what had, you know, and fish and seafood are a huge part of the Indian diet, obviously. And so I will honestly tell you that this fits with what I have been hearing about the water and the state of affairs of the water. Mm-hmm. So many in the sort of the last couple of years, food conferences or, you know, a global sort of scenarios where we as food people, as chefs get together, the conversation has substantially shifted from the land to the water.
That's really encouraging right? to hear.
Where everybody's like, no. The local farming and the organic, like that is clearly that problem's not solved. Yeah. But the emergence of the issue around the water is really has a stronghold. And it's what I love is that there's a lot of talk about even just changing our language and making sure that the water is included in our conversations around sustainability and more ecological stewardship, right? Is the way we talk about how we use the land. Mm-hmm. Right. And our very beloved David Suzuki, I believe, has forecasted that in just another 10 years is all that's left.
Really?
For us to be able to harvest proper edible things out of the water, yes.
Oh my goodness.
Right. And look, I would tend to trust a man like David Suzuki. But it is a real issue. And I actually love your connection to the advice of the dietetic world, because I think that they are more culpable than they are being pointed at for, you know?
Because what I'm seeing is, you know, people who are trying to eat healthy, definitely, you know, cutting down on red meat.
Yes.
And, you know, there are many different reasons people change their diets. But, you know, I'm still hearing a lot of people who, you know, oh, well, I don't eat meat, but I do eat fish.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Advice for a nice lean piece of fish, right? Mm-hmm. Or on the other side of things, the advice for the good essential fatty acids that everybody wants out of the salmon.
Yeah.
Right? We have sort of a global obsession about substituting every steak with a piece of salmon. Mm-hmm. Right, which is what has us in the crazy scenario we're in, whereby we are now farming salmon and feeding salmon corn, right? Yeah. Which is like the most ridiculous.
Soy. Isn't some fish fed soy as well?
For sure, right, whatever now. Those commodity crops are, right, between the corn and the soy, just to keep it moving, because all we know is that the diet, you know, a dietitian or someone in a white lab coat. Right. Or some other sort of health advisor has said, have a good piece of fish. And we're soon going to run out of that fish. Right. It's really,
yeah,
it's
and,
really,
you know, alarming. Everyone's talking about, you know, maybe we should think about just having beef once a week, or maybe we should think about, you know, less beef. But I'm not hearing anyone saying fish just once a week. You know, everyone's.
Yeah, it's true.
So that was one of the places my mind went, and I'm so encouraged to hear that within the industry, the alarm bells are going
definitely,
off and that
definitely.
It's being talked about. Here's where my alarm bells went off. I don't know if you caught this little fun tidbit, but the author was also talking about their real issues with viruses in these fish farming population. Ooh. And a potential for zoonoses.
Oh, and we know what zoonoses are now.
Yes. So our next, you know, COVID situation could come from fish.
Well, and it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense because it's the same sort of intensified, you know, mass production driven attitude, but that's just happening in the water versus the land.
Yeah.
Right. It's because we had a conversation previously, you know, earlier on in pandemic times about the link between factory farming and the emergence of these zoonoses or these novel viruses. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's the same vibe. It's just now about this intensified, because essentially there we have factory farms out in the water there. Right. It's pretty much the same scenario.
But, you know, I'd rather us not get to that point before we address the situation.
And maybe there's something to learn from the current moment, friends. Right.
Yeah, but there's something about the ocean. There's something about it that's out of sight, out of mind.
Definitely.
A lot of people.
Definitely.
And that's unfortunate. So here's the other thing I wanted to touch on with this article, because the solution that was then proposed was lab-grown fish, investing in lab-grown meats.
Can you imagine the country with arguably some of the longest coastline of any other nation will then invest itself in lab-grown fish and seafood? My goodness. That's a real state of affairs. Paints a picture of the story, right?
So here's where I got stuck.
Yeah.
So you have mentioned in the past that you were raised on a mainly vegetarian diet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And did that include fish?
Yes. I mean, and we ate, my dad was more of a meat eater and my mom was more of a veg eater. Fish was definitely included, but we didn't eat it very often.
But you have in the past mentioned that this was a sort of a traditional way
of
eating.
Definitely.
From
yes, and I think now I'm going to say where you're heading here is that Indian culture and Indian food traditions are probably the easiest, most satisfying way to be a vegetarian.
So this is where I got
stuck,
because I know that you come via South Africa and so on and so forth. So I wasn't sure where these traditions were picked up. But my understanding was that it was the traditional Indian cuisine that you were brought up with that was mainly vegetarian. So would you say that the most of your proteins then came from fish or from?
No, most of them would have come from definitely legumes. I was curious about this myself. Right.
Why not focus on
I was
that?
Like, why are we not just eating dal? I don't understand why we'll choose to make some, you know, weird fish in a test tube when we can't just eat dal.
Okay.
Right? I was like, wait a minute, we know how to do this, people. What's happening here? And so my first thought is that there must be some other emergence around distancing people from that kind of home cooking. Mm-hmm. You know, because there are lots and lots of reports of India emerging as this, you know, the middle class emerges and more people are working, and packaged foods and fast foods have really sort of enjoyed major, major spikes in popularity.
Uh-huh.
That maybe there's some connection with the fact that every day, you know, home cooking is not the thing that it might have been. I mean, I still don't get it because India...
I'm not for a varied diet. I just feel that if the real issue is anemia and protein deficiency without touching the ocean, there are easier, more obvious solutions than let's lab grow
whitefish. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't get it either. There's something else happening there. And I think, I don't know. Now I need to do some research. I feel like I'm going to follow up once I do some research and really figure out what's actually happening. So we all know that a stay in the hospital and the food that is served is a wholeheartedly dismal situation. But I just heard this piece about somebody in the hospital during quarantine. And the thought of that, like, just made my heart race. I thought, oh my God, if all of us are enjoying the delight of all these wonderful things that we're cooking and baking, what is it like for these poor suckers? I'm sure there are many people who are stuck in the hospital during quarantine. Can you imagine a more horrible thing?
And not only that, but five weeks.
5 weeks.
5 weeks of hospital food. And as you mentioned, with quarantine, not being able to, you know, pop out.
This is it. Or get visitors or, right?
A different kind of food. Oh, that's true. Or have someone bring in food.
I'm
sure. Just relegated to hospital food for 5 weeks.
It is dismal, right? So this woman had posted about it. She's Irish and she posted her photos, which I love, right? As you can imagine, I collect these photos. They get sent to me all the time. And these are choice. Like, they are shining light examples of these awful, awful meals.
I'm going to be honest. Some of it looked like dog food.
Yes, of course it did.
And
it's
some
not
of it looked
away.
Like dog food with overcooked pasta in it. And when you can tell from a picture that pasta is overcooked.
Right. It's serious.
That's a next level mushiness.
Right. And the like, you see, there was like 3 or 4 different types of noodles and shapes underneath, like the sort of jungle juice pasta collection, who knows where and what, and with no intention.
Yeah.
It was, and the thing that I noticed, so you noticed all those photos, there's so much smear on the plates, right? Everything is really jostled around and looking really haphazard. The story that tells is the story of these retherm boxes. Right? Because these things are plated up in trade and then these boxes get plugged in to bring everything up to temperature. But the journey that they have to take down these hallways and then up these elevator rides has the trays swinging back and forth, which is what makes, which is what presents this like sloshed out, really careless sort of tray in front of people, right?
Everything was moved to a corner of the plate. Yes. The most poignant piece for me of this whole article was the fact that this woman has cystic fibrosis and she, her diet has a huge impact on her health.
Right.
She mentioned she's supposed to be eating more,
double the calories, quantities.
Yes. She has a lot of food. She did mention that she's picky, but she also has food sensitivities and very real issues she has to deal with. And so this, can we use the term malnourishment?
100%.
Is that too aggressive?
Not at all. Okay. I call it edible food-like substances. It's totally fair.
It's not just her morale that's being impacted here. It's, you know, a very real threat to her health. And
yes.
It was interesting to see, she said, in some hospitals, they have a special chef for the cystic fibrosis.
Right, for the CF patients. Yeah.
Wing, because, I mean, anything you can do to help these people stay healthy is important, but you know, I'm sure you will agree with me that it's not just the cystic fibrosis wing that needs a new.
No, not at all. It is such a sadness. I mean, already I am railing against hospital food in a large way, but just the acute intensity of being stuck in there during quarantine when health crises are such an issue, and to have no comfort in something that you eat, to be, you know, be sort of forced into the indignity of this, never mind detrimental therapeutic impact because it's just not the right thing for you to be eating.
Mm-hmm.
I really felt for her. We actually had a little Twitter interaction because she posted something and somebody else tagged me in it.
Oh, nice.
And so we had a little back and forth chat, and she had a lot of angry things to say about the chefs and the cooks in the kitchen, right? She was convinced that it was that they didn't care enough. And I am sure this sloshy plating informed some of that because it just looks like the human who was involved did not care at all about what they were doing.
I know from reading your book that that's not necessarily
not at all
the case, and that a lot of people are in the kitchen feel equally depressed about the situation doing the best that they can under the circumstances within, the budgets and the regulations and the crazy reconfigured
decisions.
Kitchens that are just, what are those heating things called again?
Retherm units.
So the retherm units. Yeah, it's a very real problem. But I have to say, she did manage to, with the photo essay, to make it, you know, somewhat entertaining.
She did. And she still got a sense of humor about it too, God bless her.
A great way to get the word out there. Thanks for pointing that article out.
I think so. Thanks. All right, Mirella, this one's a little bit silly, but it's also curious. I found this piece. I'm not sure if you heard the fanfare when it was released, but Popeye's Chicken, which is a very popular American or, you know, owned fast food chain, I think like last year sometime released a chicken sandwich and America lost their minds. Everybody could not stop talking about the Popeye's Chicken sandwich.
And you might be shocked to learn that it was not on my radar at all.
Right.
Although I remember that the last chicken sandwich I remember that made a fuss was the KFC sandwich where the outside was the bun was the chicken.
The double down. It was called the double down,
which I still haven't
tried. Chicken thighs were the bun. Exactly.
Okay. So I understand. And I know what Popeyes is. So.
Right. And so I, with the rest of my food community, everyone was like, what is such a big deal about this chicken sandwich? People went over to the US and ate it and told stories of this magical sandwich. So then I found this piece that talked about Popeye's efforts and what they're doing to bring this sandwich to Canada, right? Mm-hmm. Now is the time, and they have decided that it's coming to Canada. So the piece that I found has this like painstaking detail about the right kind of pickles and the right bun and the whatever. And listen, I have to honestly tell you, I sensed a little, I wasn't in love with a sort of quiet suggestion that the Canadian market was a sort of like hinterland and nobody, you know, they were like not sure whether they would find pickles and buns.
Right.
Because this, I was like, guys, we have some pickle, like, please. Right. also hilarious that they were like, they said that sourcing everything in Canada was a cheaper option than importing it all from the US.
Yes.
Right. And I was like, yes, sure. If that's what it takes to focus on locally sourced food, Popeyes, amazing. But the thing I love the most was this amazing like twisting of the idea, right? Because they were suggesting that they would still use their U.S. chicken because they only use, quote, full muscle product, which is like my favorite line from this whole story.
Yeah, well, it just means that they're not grinding up the chicken.
Exactly, right? They want the whole breast. And they can grow the chickens to the required specs.
Can I just tell you?
Yeah.
I just read that. And every time I read something like that now, this alarm bell rings in the back of my head. Zunos! Zunos! You're making all these chickens so that they're identical.
Right?
The virus is going to, you know, wash through them. And
yes.
I can think now.
Yes, and we remain at home.
And they're bragging about it, right?
This is exactly it, my friend. This is exactly it. We see the cycle now, right?
Yeah.
Because we all stuck at home wanting Popeyes to deliver us chicken sandwiches, right? It goes around in circles.
Yeah, it needs to be that perfect, as you said, what was it?
Full
muscle product, yes.
Right? It's really, really interesting to see that they're like, your Canadian farms are not good enough. Our American farms are better because we can grow to spec a 200 gram chicken breast.
Oh my goodness.
Right now, funnier bit though, was other curiosities of the Canadian market, right? Which I love the fact that when they tested it, because it's launching in Edmonton first.
Yeah.
Right. And so the fact that when they did some market research and some focus group testing, they discovered that Canadians need a slice of tomato. Right,
and we
need some lettuce and tomato on our sandwich.
That gave me hope. Here's the first thing that struck me about this article. I have to say, because you know, there, this sandwich is four ingredients, right? The bun, the chicken, the pickles, and the sauce.
Right,
and they carefully tested each one in Canada to make sure that whatever they were sourcing locally was identical to the original. And it brought me back to episode 18 when we were talking about the corn, where people were growing new varieties of corn and putting zero effort into the sensory space.
Right.
How it tastes like.
That's right.
And
that's
first of all, how fascinating that, you know, there's so much more effort in fast food than there is in the raw ingredients.
Like vegetables.
And secondly, that I just found it entertaining because at the end of the day, you're just plugging holes. You know, if more time and attention was put into the actual taste of the raw ingredients, then perhaps it wouldn't be so tricky to make the end product.
Exactly.
Take an entire year to match four ingredients.
Right?
You know, I'm sure you've noticed when you go to countries that have, you know, a brighter, for me, like when I'm on the Mediterranean, like just a tomato tastes like so much better. You know, the growing conditions can really result in huge flavor varieties within the exact same thing. I found it entertaining. You know,
it is maybe... it really, and it just, it's a great bit of evidence about how tunneled we can get in this world of industrial food and thinking of food as products.
Yeah.
Right. And just, these are the specs. You cannot satisfy my requirements. These are, you know, this is done. Who cares what Mother Nature has to say? I love it.
But what I thought was really fascinating was this description. I don't know if you saw, I think it was a woman from a food critic in the US. And she talked about this high amplitude balance of salt, fat, sharpness, and softness that occurs when you put all of these four ingredients together.
That was
together.
The New York Times food critic who said that.
The New York Times food critic.
She's a full-on food critic. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it made me realize what they've achieved with this combination of ingredients is a bliss point.
Yes.
Right? Remember we're talking
nice
about that
one.
Bliss point?
Totally. So, that's early on in our time. Yes, yes, yes.
And it was very interesting to me because we talked about the bliss point in the context of, like, you know, a soft drink, you know, making it that, giving it
that's
that perfect
right,
balance.
That's right.
Or, but there's also this other idea that you can combine four ingredients together to reach a bliss point once they are assembled. And I think
right.
that's the engineering behind this sandwich.
Yes.
Because clearly, I mean, if it took them 4 years to match the ingredients, they put some thought into this sandwich, let's face it.
Clearly they did.
And this is making me super curious now to try it. Mm-hmm. This idea that the bliss point has been achieved with the core ingredients. I might
That's
even
it.
Issue the, you know, the lettuce and tomato, which are so important to me, just to, you know, be able to taste the original sandwich.
If you're enjoying our podcast, please support us at patreon.com/hotplatepod. Hot Plate is part of the Frequency Podcast Network. Please consider leaving us a rating or review. It helps others find us. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hot Plate Pod. Follow me at Beerology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And follow Joshna at Joshna Maharaj on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Original music by Dave Bell. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato, that's me, and Dennis Coyne. Thanks for listening.